Welcome to the Colorado Court of Appeals. We have one case set for the afternoon docket, which is Amos and the State of Rigetti versus Aspen Alps and Equitable Bank. Before we run the timer here, I understand that there was or is a request for additional time for oral argument. Is that correct?
We have believed made such a request.
Okay. How much extra time did you ask for?
We did not ask.
Yeah,
how much time did you ask for?
I forget what we asked for because it was denied. I said that the court might allow us to use some extra time, but we had 15 before the scale or extra hours to know within that period of time.
So, okay. Would you object if I gave both sides an extra 5 minutes?
No.
All right. Then each side is allowed a total of 20 minutes. How you divide it up between cross appeal and between parties and so forth is up to you. Do you need a minute to straighten that out before we start the arguments? All right. Have both counsel received our written statement of procedures? And do you have any questions? All right. If any members of the audience have a cell phone pager, would you please turn it off so that the attorneys are not interrupted during oral argument? Can the bailiff set the clock for 20 minutes per side there rather than 15? On that basis, I believe we are ready for arguments in Amos versus Aspen Alps.
May it please the court, I am Wiley Main, appearing on behalf of the appellants. The trial court's judgment in this case erroneously resulted in Betty Amos and the estate of her late husband, Dr. Tom Rigetti, forfeiting $1.5 million in equity in their property, despite their timely tender of the redemption amount to the public trustee, despite the foreclosing bank's gross noncompliance with Rule 120, and despite the foreclosure bidder's violation of antitrust law. Let me focus this afternoon first on reasons why the foreclosure should have been voided. First, the foreclosure was void because the bidders at the foreclosure sale rigged the bidding in violation of Colorado antitrust law. Analysis of the bid rigging issue entails the application of the trial court's finding of fact to unremarkable propositions of antitrust law. Bid rigging at foreclosure sales is illegal. Bid rigging is a per se violation of the antitrust laws. Well, what is bid rigging? The cases tell us that bid rigging is an agreement between competitors pursuant to which offers are to be withheld from a third party. The trial court's finding of fact shows that the conduct of the Aspen Alps members in this case fits that definition precisely. At the foreclosure sale, they were competitors. They entered into an agreement. The agreement was to withhold further bids from the public trustee. The trial court's finding of fact is explicit. The court wrote, Tom Griffin, one of the bidders, suggested to Ms. Mayer and Mr. Siegman, the other two bidders, that instead of bidding the property up further and further, that they form an LLC and buy it together. They all agreed and the bidding stopped. They were competitors. They entered into an agreement. The agreement was to withhold further bids from the public trustee.
Pardon me for interrupting you, Mr. Main. I'd like to ask you a question about that, if I may, please.
Certainly.
I want to go specifically to the issue of agreement. And you mentioned the trial court's findings. The trial court also found that there was, quote, no criminal intent, unquote. I understand that this is a civil case, not a criminal case. But in that regard, when the court found that there was no, quote, criminal intent, unquote, I want to lay out my question to you based upon whether that means the court was finding that there was no agreement to do what is prohibited by bid rigging. Specifically, let me look to these facts. There is at least some evidence, some may be disputed, but some evidence in the record to suggest that there was no agreement among the bidders before Mr. Griffin said what he said into which you alluded. Secondly, there was no evidence of other bidders beyond these three. And last, there was some evidence, and I understand you dispute it, and I respect that, but there was some evidence that Griffin and Myers did not have any means to exceed Seguin's, I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly, Seguin's last bid. Doesn't that support a finding as a factual matter that the bidders did not have an agreement to reduce, eliminate, or interfere with competition?
I would suggest that we don't know what the motives were other than the plain motive to stop the competition and the express agreement not to bid the price up further and further. So the agreement, the stated purpose of the agreement was we won't increase the bid price. Having said that, however, I would suggest that the more important aspect of this is that it is clear, because this is a per se violation of law, that their motives and intent are irrelevant. If we look at the definition of bid rigging that's set forth in the Guthrie case, that's an ABA model jury instruction. It says explicitly that it does not matter what the intent of the parties was. The Guthrie case states you don't have to have criminal intent to be guilty of bid rigging. And a fortiori, in a civil case, it's a lesser standard.
I'm not trying to quibble with you, Mr. Main, but in Coppers, there is clearly some suggestion that for a per se violation, and I'm assuming for the purposes of argument that this is per se, but for a per se violation, you don't have to show any effect. But I think doesn't it appear somewhat clear in Coppers that there has to be some, at least there has to be proof of an agreement? And if the parties did not intend to do these things, then is there no agreement?
Well, they plainly intended, Your Honor, to withhold further bids. That's an agreement with an express intent. There is a factual finding that there was an agreement, and the agreement was to withhold further bids. That is the definition of bid rigging. And whether they had a criminal intent, whether they actually intended to restrain competition, is irrelevant because it is a per se violation. And the definition, that jury instruction, which lays out the law in detail, is explicit about not having to have, a guilty state of mind. It says expressly that they could have benign motives. It would still be a violation of law.
I have a two-part question, and let me phrase them both so you don't feel like you're trapped. First, is there any evidence in the record that Mayer and Griffin had the capacity to best the $1.86 million bid that was on the table? And second, if there is no such evidence, why should we set aside the foreclosure?
The evidence was that Mr. Griffin had no authority to bid higher than Mr. Seguin's bid. But, of course, the evidence also was that Mr. Griffin stated to Mr. Seguin and Ms. Mayer, we can continue to bid this up further and further. I suggest that is evidence that Mr. Griffin could have and would have bid higher. But what Mr. Griffin also could have done, if he and Ms. Mayer were truly tapped out, if that was the fact, then the two of them could have joined forces in permissible joint bidding and bid against Mr. Siegwood.
Is there any, and I appreciate that argument, is there any, did you or whoever was trial counsel develop any evidence in deposition or in examining these people at trial that they even contemplated doing that?
Well, in the deposition, the testimony was that all three parties agreed to acquire the property jointly.
No, my question, I apologize if it was awkward, was a little bit different. Is there any evidence that Griffin thought about joining forces with Mayer, or that Mayer thought about joining forces with Griffin, separate and apart from the three-party agreement?
Well, not separate and apart from the three-party agreement, but I would suggest to Your Honor that that shows that both of them were willing to enter into such an agreement. That's evidence. The fact that they were prepared to buy jointly is strong evidence, probative of the fact that they would have and could have joined together to compete against Mr. Siegel.
Okay, but I mean, in depositions or a trial, either Griffin or Mayer could have been asked, did you give any thought whatsoever to trying to freeze Mr. Segway out by forming a two-party agreement? Was that question asked?
That question was not asked.
Thank you. Well, and I guess that leads to my next question. Why should we set aside the foreclosure if there's no evidence in the record, specific evidence, that either Ms. Mayer or Mr. Griffin had the financial wherewithal to best the $1.86 million winning bid?
Two reasons, Your Honor. First is, this is a per se violation of the antitrust laws. Therefore, it is legally irrelevant whether there was injury. Injury is presumed.
Okay, but is the per se violation that we would address setting aside the foreclosure, which gives your client a second bite at the apple, or would it simply be, you know, voiding the three-party agreement and, you know, allowing the trial court to do something on remand by way of reformation?
Well, I believe, Your Honor, that the Colorado statute specifically gives us guidance there, and it says that the contract that they obtained is void. So the deed that they got is legally void.
Which section are you referring to that says
I believe
the contract
6-4-127, I believe, Your Honor.
Thank you.
No, 121, I'm sorry. 6-4-121. So the deed is void, and so we have to go back and have a new foreclosure sale, and that's what the trial court should have ordered.
Counselor, could I direct you in a different direction if you're finished?
Certainly.
Addressing this one. I'm interested in Rule 120.
Yes.
And the dues case and strict compliance, and how we reconcile strict compliance with actual notice in this case.
Well, the first thing I would say about that is strict compliance trumps actual notice. And we've cited authority for that proposition in our briefs. The question I would, the follow-up I would make to your question is that here we have strict compliance because we are talking about due process considerations. We're talking about taking away property. And the Supreme Court set down specific guidelines in Rule 120, and shortly after setting down those guidelines, it said in Dues versus District Court, these guidelines must be strictly complied with, and they specifically alluded to the due process considerations. Dues should not fairly be read to say strict compliance is required only with respect to the timeliness of the notice that people get. Indeed, the due process considerations of failing to identify persons who are entitled to notice is far more consequential than the due process considerations of untimely notice. So it is a fair reading of dues in these circumstances that dues calls for strict compliance not only with the timeliness of notice, but with who is to get notice. Certainly, our facts are not the same as Dews versus District Court, but the statements of the Supreme Court, two different statements, that strict compliance is the rule, are equally applicable to who gets notice. And here we know that the bank knew about the estate, knew Dr. Rigetti was dead, knew that he was somebody who was required to be identified under the rule, knew that Brandy Rigetti was the co-personal representative of that estate, but didn't identify either of them in its sworn motion submitted to the district court. In other words, it falsely represented under oath to the district court that it had identified all the people who were required by the rule to be identified. That to us is not a minor shortcoming. That is not a mere technicality.
If you finished your answer to my colleague, what is it about due process, and if you've got a case, I'd be very curious as to the citation, that requires, well, excuse me, what is it about due process that forecloses a no harm, no foul analysis based on actual notice to Mrs. Amos at a time when she was and clearly knew she was a co-PR of the estate and was represented by counsel? I mean, I could see we could take a very narrow and literal interpretation of the rule, and that would be consistent with Dews. But what is it about the broader principle of due process, which to me would seem to be more akin to an actual notice, actual harm inquiry than a strict compliance inquiry?
Well, what I'd say about that, Your Honor, is that we need to look at the circumstance here. The circumstance is that the bank foreclosing here is initiating a legal proceeding. This isn't just a notice that's going out on some run-of-the-mill aspect of the proceedings. This is initiating the proceeding. It is akin to starting a lawsuit by serving a complaint. And there are formalities to be observed, and you consistently, the courts say that due process requires that those formalities be complied with. Now, and I would suggest that failing to interpret due process as requiring the adherence to those formalities in this circumstance opens the door to unintended consequences prejudicial to property owners whose property is at risk of being taken from them in the foreclosure proceedings.
Pardon me, Mr. Main. Have you finished your answer to Judge Wells?
Yes.
You used the word Trump in your answer to Judge Roman. Why doesn't 3838505 Trump Rule 120 in this context? Because it specifically talks about the people whom you say were omitted from the notice.
Well, it does not trump 120 because it doesn't have anything to do with the obligations of the foreclosing party. The moving party, the foreclosing party, the bank, whichever title you wish to put to it, is not even mentioned in 505. The Supreme Court has laid down what the obligations of the moving party are in Rule 120. There is no conflict between 505 and 120 in terms of what the obligations of the bank are.
Was the public trustee involved in this sale?
Ultimately, but it's important to remember that the procedure here is that the bank first has to go to the court and get an order. And it's only after the bank complies with Rule 120 and gets the order and then that the public trustee then becomes involved. So here, before any involvement of the public trustee, a serious breach of Rule 120 had occurred. I'd like to save my remaining time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Matthew Ferguson, and I represent Aspen Alps 123, and with me today is one of the members, Deborah Mayer, from Aspen, Colorado. At bottom, this is a commercial lending case with its genesis in the state of Florida. These are business loans that were defaulted on and happened to be secured by a piece of property in Aspen, Colorado, which went into foreclosure, as you all know. Your Honors, just a few themes, and I want to tell you what I can handle, what I will argue, and obviously answer the panel's questions. First and foremost, the fact is that this case has ample due process. Mr. Rodriguez is going to handle the 120 issues for the Equitable Bank. I'm happy to answer any questions on it, but we join with Equitable Bank in both its brief and probably in its argument here today. Simply put, there is five arguments that have been raised, five areas. It would be the 120, the redemption, the bid rigging, and then the fees and the damages claims. I'm prepared to handle both the bid rigging and the redemption to the extent it needs to be discussed any further. Let me move through those issues very quickly. This whole case is tainted by an inescapable fact that the trial court has found numerous times and in numerous decisions that the attempted redemption was based upon a falsehood. That fact taints the entire case, and the issues that you just raised with Mr. Main regarding due process do not are further supported by the fact that they came to court to challenge the and force a redemption by the public trustee who's not here today, and they're pretty much a dormant party right now. But that's how the case started. Rule 120 wasn't raised until further along in the case. In any event, real quickly on 120, all I'm going to say is that dues is not a playground to expand. That strict compliance had to do with those facts. And Mr. Main has indicated that those facts are very different than what occurred here. And in that case, as you all know, the people that were being foreclosed on did not have ample time. They both lawyered up with Denver law firms and appeared in a court to challenge the 120. Even given the fact that they were less than 2 or 3 days here,
let me ask you this before you move on. Why shouldn't we interpret strict compliance to mean exactly that, strict compliance, like several of the other jurisdictions have done?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, several jurisdictions have also said that actual notice, and so strict compliance, it's a playing field. The courts here and in other jurisdictions look at the circumstances. Dues says strict compliance on the issue of giving notice and giving timely notice. In that case, it just wasn't mailed. The folks didn't get it. Those issues, those factual issues, just aren't implicated here. So you can take any strict compliance case from any jurisdiction. Some say actual notice, as Mr. Main says, trumps it in other jurisdictions, depending on the facts of the case and the law implicated, will hold the strict compliance. But what you see is the courts doing a balancing test of what strict compliance means, what it's intended to do. And at bottom, it's intended to give notice and to afford everyone a due process. Here, we know from the record that Ms. Amos, as a co-person representative of the state, had all these notices, had lawyers, three or four lawyers are in the record at Holland and Hart knowing about this, giving her advice that she had 75 days to redeem, and just didn't do it. So the concern I have, or the concern we should have with the strict compliance in dues is, and the trial court said it, I will find that there's strict compliance. What do you do when you are faced with facts where the person who's being foreclosed on gets notice at 3 and 4 addresses?
Let me ask you this. Sure. Are you aware of any other Colorado cases where under Rule 120, strict compliance didn't mean exactly that?
No. Okay. I'm not. All right. But that's why I think both parties have gone and looked at the concepts of strict compliance in various jurisdictions. And I believe that the better law is set forth in the cases that we've cited, which is, listen, the person, that's the case of the fellow that didn't want the notice tacked on his door, and so you've got cases like that where the courts are looking at the circumstances. The circumstances here are overwhelmingly that the purpose of the 120 was served. They got the notice and whatnot. I don't want to steal Mr. Rodriguez's thunder on 120, and I'm happy to answer any questions. Otherwise, I'll move quickly on to bid rigging. First, Your Honors, as the court knows from the record, the bid rigging or rigging of bid claim was not allowed. It came on April 24th, just weeks before trial and after the discovery cutoff. It was alleged that it was a newly discovered fact. It wasn't. Ms. Wancora, who conducted the trial, the sale rather, was on the stand in Glenwood Springs and testified at Foley about the what happened at that sale a year before that claim was made. So the court denied it, allowing the amendment of the claim, but Amos was allowed to utilize rigging of bids as a defense to our claims that we had damages for the spurious liens.
So it'll be your position that even if we found bid rigging based on the ruling of the trial court, we couldn't set aside the foreclosure, but we might treat it as a defense to the fee awards?
Your Honor, I'm sorry, I didn't hear the entire question, but the procedurally, I'm sorry.
So it's your position that even if we found bid rigging, based on the way the trial court ruled, we couldn't set aside the foreclosure, but we might consider bid rigging as a defense to the fee awards?
The bid rigging defense, I believe, was only allowed by the trial court as a defense to the claim, the counterclaims that remain. I believe that's how it came in. But we've raised the issue that this defense was never pled. It was allowed in just because that's what happens in trial courts. Procedurally, we've put in our briefs that it's pretty much a nullity. But the fact of the matter, Judge Webb, is that it was tried, and it was tried on the fly on the with no discovery. And as the court has amply discussed with Mr. Main, the evidence adduced there was a hearsay of Ms. Mayer about what she thought Mr. Griffin said at a deposition. But the evidence that we were able to rebut was no one had any more money. Mr. Main and Amos want to continue to argue that this is a per se violation because competition was stopped. Competition wasn't stopped. Competition had stopped. It was over, right? Guthrie and Coppers is, I believe, the Connecticut case with the East and the West, the people dividing up the state of Connecticut for asphalt contracts. Those cases and the Romer case out of Virginia, these are criminal enterprises. We got one federal judge calling the Romers cohorts. They go and they buy people off at sales beforehand. They're prosecuted by the government. In this case, we had three good faith purchasers, cogs in the banking system. Without bidders, you have no foreclosure process. They came there with cash. Ms. Mayer ran out at 1.75 or 1.8, she didn't recall exactly, and Mr. Griffin, who had Mr. Griffin there on his behalf, had given no authority. That's the evidence. It had stopped. Your Honors, I would suggest that this is if you were to criminalize this act, then any time anyone went to a charity function and bid on the condo trip to Costa Rica and the wife said, let's share it, let's both go, that would be a criminal act. It's not. This was a 17 to 18 minute process that Ms. Wancora set forth. She date stamped it. She went in $50,000 increments. At best, I'll suggest, Your Honors, that Mr. Griffin was bluffing. Bluffing at cards is okay. Cheating at cards isn't. There was no cheating here. They were out of money. They agree, and the trial court found that they had an absolute right to contract. They formed this bid. We met, and bear in mind, if this defense was allowed, which it was, then they had the burden of proof. They had a deposition snippet of two people, and we came to court and we were able to put on two witnesses and said the bidding was over. So, Your Honors, this case is I think the trial court's decision on this should be upheld. The court saw the credibility of the witnesses, listened to the facts, and was able to determine that this was not bid rigging. It might have been joint bidding, but there was no criminal act here. There was no conspiracy. There was no agreement to chill competition, no pernicious reasons. And the courts, Guthrie may say that there's a concept of per se violations, but just like strict compliance, the federal courts, when looking at the Sherman Act, there's no one really looking at the Colorado Act here too much. When they're looking at it, they're looking at the circumstances of the cases. You don't have cohorts in Connecticut dividing up the asphalt contracts. You don't have people buying off and chilling bidders altogether. This was an innocent and good faith sale conducted by an able trustee, and my client's sale should be purchase should be upheld. Thank you. Thank you, Your Honors. I think that was 10 minutes.
May it please the court, my name is Rich Rodriguez. I represent Equitable Bank. I will spend my time today discussing the Rule 120 and public trustee statutory issues. I want to talk first about CRS 3838-505, which was repealed and reenacted in 1990 after the Dues case and after the changes to Rule 120. This statute deals specifically with the situation here where you have a property owner and or grantor who has died prior to a foreclosure. The statute is clear that any foreclosure shall be good against the personal representatives of any decedent or any person claiming by, through, or under the decedent, notwithstanding the fact that the lender may have a claim against the estate and irrespective of the death of the owner. That's 3838-505-1. The statute further provides that the personal representatives or heirs shall be given notice only if their claim or interest then appear of record. Now, of record means recorded in the offices of the clerk and recorder where the property is located, in this instance, Pitkin County.
Well, if we are to take 505 as trumping Rule 120, why should we do that since 505 doesn't refer to 120? 120 doesn't refer to 505, and the committee comment to 120 doesn't refer to 505.
The answer to the question, Your Honor, is I don't believe it's our argument that that the statute trumps Rule 120. It's our argument that the statute and the rule are coextensive and consistent.
Well, aren't you arguing, I apologize for poor choice of words, aren't you arguing that 505 essentially presents a standard of conduct that a foreclosing creditor under Rule 120 should follow for purposes of giving notice to interests of estates?
That's true.
Okay, well, why should we do that since 505 doesn't refer to 120, 120 doesn't refer to 505, and the logical place for such a cross-reference from a 120 perspective would seem to be in the committee comment, which is silent?
I would suggest to the contrary, Your Honor, for two reasons. One, when the committee was revising Rule 120, the statute was in effect, and presumably the committee, when they made the recommendation to the Supreme Court, knew about the statute with respect to notice to personal representatives and heirs, and it specifically chose not to make any reference to any personal representatives and heirs when they made the changes to the rules. The other more important reason why I think that the statute should apply in this case is, as I said previously, both the statute and the rule apply coextensively and consistently. And as I get through this argument later, I will go through what was required under Rule 20 and show you why the statute and the rule are consistent and can be applied in a manner that is consistent with the entire scheme of the statutory process.
Okay.
Getting back to the issue of record notice, the Amos appellants argue that a bargain and sale deed conveying a linen closet constitutes record notice of the estate's interest in Unit 706. They say that the linen closet constitutes part of the unit as a matter of condominium law, and therefore we had record notice of the estate's interest. But the appellants misapply the statute upon which they rely. The statute that they discuss in the brief discusses the inseparability of common elements and units only for those common elements that are appurtenant to an individual's airspace unit by the terms of the recorded declaration and only for the period of time that is prescribed by the recorded declaration. There's no record evidence that establishes that the linen closet was appurtenant to Unit 706 by the terms of a recorded declaration. There's no record evidence regarding any of the terms of any recorded declaration. Therefore, the cited statute does not help them.
So the declaration isn't in the record?
That's correct.
Thank you.
They also argue that the estate's interest would have appeared under Betty Amos's name in the grantor-grantee indices. They cite no evidence in the record to support this argument. The only evidence in the record regarding record interests is the title policies obtained by Aspen Alps and us. In those title policies, neither the estate nor Brandy Rigetti appear as record interest holders. If reputable title company searches did not find their interest, we should have found their interests.
Did you present expert testimony on whether a grantor-grantee index search would have picked up Mrs. Amos?
We did not. There was no evidence in the record whatsoever with respect to whether a search under her name would have resulted in locating this bargain and sale deed.
So we're dealing with essentially your argument is a legal conclusion and not a matter of disputed facts.
That's correct.
Thank you.
The linen closet deed deals with different property, and Brandy Rigetti had no record interest in Unit 706 at the time it was recorded. Therefore, we believe it's the classic case of a wild deed that didn't give the bank notice of the estate's interest. Let's talk about Rule 120. As an initial matter, it's important for the court to remember two things about Rule 120. One, a Rule 120 motion is not the beginning, it is not the end. It is in the middle. A foreclosure process through the public trustee is actually begun by the filing of a notice and election of demand for sale. And there are several forms that go with that to the borrowers, and it is only after all of the publication periods have expired and all of the notices have been sent out that the lender files a Rule 120 motion. And that's what happened in this instance. Betty Amos received copies of the notice and election of demand. She sent copies of all that information to Holland and Hart. And when she received the motion, she sent that to Holland and Hart. And we'll talk about later about what she did. But the Rule 120 motion was filed. She chose not to respond. There was no hearing held as a result, and the sale went forward. She still had an opportunity to participate in the process by redemption. But as you know, that's an issue as to whether or not she complied with that. But it's very important that you understand first where Rule 120 fits into the process. And it's also important to know, as you know, that the scope of inquiry under Rule 120 is very narrow. All the court looks at on a Rule 120 hearing is there a reasonable probability of default, and is there the authority to exercise a power of sale? It's not an opportunity for the borrower to show up and raise collateral issues to those two issues. And in this particular instance, the evidence is that there was not only a reasonable probability, there was undisputed evidence that she was in default and there was no defense to the exercise of a power of sale. They don't want to talk about that. They want to gloss over the fact that the Rule 120 hearing is really a very limited hearing, and they had plenty of opportunities to respond and participate in this process. But let's talk specifically about the requirements. As you know, under subsection A of the rule, the bank was required to send notice to the grantor and grantees and the record owner at the last known addresses. Number two, to any person known or believed to be personally liable upon the secured indebtedness. And number three, to those persons who have appeared to acquire a record interest after a certain time frame before the notice of election and demand. I want to start.
Do you dispute that the bank's own files show that it knew Dr. Rigetti was deceased and it knew Brandy Rigetti had been appointed co-PR?
I do not dispute that, but it's immaterial for these two reasons. Number one, both 38.5.05 and Rule 120 specifically talk about anybody that anybody has to have a record interest.
Isn't Rule 120 also cast alternatively in terms of persons whose interests appear from the foreclosing creditor's own records?
It does not. Rule 120 has two components. Well, I'm sorry, I should correct my response. It does with respect to the grantor and the record owner of the property, but it doesn't with respect to any other party who may have an interest. That is limited to recorded interests. But I want to talk about those who appear to have acquired a record interest in the property. Note the similarity in this language to 3838505. And both of these say that for purposes of that portion of the rule in 3838505, you only have to give notice to those persons having record interests. Thus, Rule 120 and the statute can be applied coextensively and consistently. As discussed before, neither the estate nor Brandy Rigetti held any record interest in the property. Am I out of time?
Yes.
Okay. I'd like to just discuss, if I could, one final point.
Briefly, and then I have one question.
I do want to address the Deuce case.
Well, I think we can read the Deuce case. I think we're aware of it, and we can read it.
Okay.
I have one question, and I'll give the other side a little extra time to respond as well. Let's assume we agree with the trial court that the only basis on which the bank can get fees is the pledge agreement signed by Mrs. Amos. You understand the assumption?
I understand.
Okay. How can that pledge agreement, which was not signed by Dr. Rigetti, support the trial court's award of any fees against the estate for the benefit of the bank?
The answer to the question, Your Honor, is because there were two pledge agreements. There was a pledge agreement that was executed by Abkey Number 1 and Betty Amos in favor of the bank, and there was a separate pledge agreement that was executed by Thomas Rigetti and Betty Amos.
But didn't the trial court predicate its findings only on the first pledge agreement?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. The trial court in its findings referenced both pledge agreements. That finding was not appealed by the appellants, and the basis for our motion for attorney's fees was under both pledge agreements.
Thank you. Mr. Main, since I gave the other side a little extra time, if you want to respond to my question about the pledge agreements in the estate before we turn the clock on, go ahead for a minute or so.
Yes, the answer to that is that there is a second pledge agreement, which is asserted to have existed, is not in the record. So we have no idea what that pledge agreement says or what rights the bank may have under that separate pledge agreement.
Okay.
It's simply not in the record.
Okay, let's turn the clock off for a minute. I appreciate that your answer. Have you separately challenged the bank's fee award on the basis that even if it is proper as against Mrs. Amos, it is improper against the estate because the estate has not signed any documents? Is that an issue that you've raised or not?
We have not raised that issue.
Okay. All right. Let's run the clock then, and you can finish your rebuttal.
I would say simply that the award. I'll just leave it
okay.
At that. We have not suggested that the estate is not a signer of
okay.
The claim.
Question on the bid rigging: then. Have you separately appealed the trial court's order limiting the scope of that defense?
Well, the answer to that, I think, Your Honor, is that we have appealed the trial court's judgment.
Okay, but you haven't separately challenged the procedural order that limited the role in which bid rigging would play.
That's right, because we did not need to. The issues that went to trial included Aspen Alps' claim to quiet title to the property. So the result of the proper application of the bid rigging defense, successful application of that defense, is title is not quieted in Aspen Alps, ergo it's quieted in Amos and the estate.
Okay. Did the trial court's order recognize the bid rigging as a defense to the quiet title claim? Or only is it
yes,
only
yes. I mean, the trial court's judgment specifically grants the quiet title relief sought, and denies the defense.
Okay.
So, yes, it was a defense to the quiet title claim. Let me say quickly with respect also to bid rigging is that there is no question from the record that the sequence of events was that the agreement was reached first and then the bidding stopped. So this isn't a case in which the the bidding stopped and then an agreement was reached.
Yeah, I gave your other side a sentence or two, so go ahead and wrap up.
Let me say quickly with respect to Rule 120, 505 and 120 are at odds. 120 says that the bank had to give notice to the estate, and we argue to Brandy Rigetti. If you interpret 505 the way the bank asks you to, they are clearly at odds, but they don't need to be. 505 properly interpreted does not vitiate 120's requirement that that notice be given. Thank you.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel, and we appreciate your willingness to adjust the timing. It went fine. The case stands submitted. We will issue a written opinion in due course. On that basis, counsel are excused. The other case on our docket has been stricken, and therefore the bailiff may announce a recess.